Hey, what is going on, Los Angeles? It's J.T.Dot, and I hope that you're so well. On this installment of JT the LA Storyteller podcast, yours truly chats it up with Susie Exposito, who's a music reporter at the LA Times, as well as a columnist with the new Delos platform and initiative, which you learned about in just the last episode. In this convo, we talk about Bad Bunny, as well as the music scene over the last decade especially. We also discuss Susie's transition from Rolling Stone to the LA Times, as well as the city of Los Angeles and things of note, including East Coast Latinidad versus West Coast Latinidad. And we have a convo on red or green salsa and which Susie prefers, which is important. Okay, if you haven't yet hit that follow or subscribe button for the show, please do so ASAP. And if you haven't reviewed the show, please do that just as well, because it helps tons. And until the next time, you already know, stay vigilant and stay tuned. It's J.T.Dot out with more soon. It's Jimbo times. Susie Exposito, thank you so very much for joining me on this installment of JT the LA Storyteller podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on, JT.
It's so much fun because I suppose that a lifetime ago when I wanted to do something like recording and broadcasting to the general public, I didn't necessarily know that I would fan out over featuring, say, a writer on the show. But I am. Yeah.
Thank you.
I am now.
Little old me.
That's right. So for those of y'all who don't know, Susie Exposito is a writer with the Los Angeles Times, or the LA Times for short, who hails from a wide background, especially Latin American music, I would say. Yep. But, you know, you can correct me if I'm slightly mistaken there. Tell us more about your background and how you got to the LAT for a moment.
Yeah, well, where do I begin? I am an East Coaster by birth. I was born in Jersey City, New Jersey, and like a lot of Cuban people, I'm half Cuban, half Belizean. Like a lot of Cuban people, my family moved down to Miami because Jersey wasn't cutting it. I spent most of my childhood in Miami. Then I went to high school in Jacksonville, Florida, which is North Florida, and I also call it Southern Georgia. Mm. The vibe is so different there. And I moved back to New York for college. I went to the New School, and I got a degree in journalism from the New School. And after that, you know, I mean, I've been a music journalist since I was in high school. I started writing record reviews, and because it was the 2000s, we're talking like My Chemical Romance era, you know, Paramore era, The Killers, you know, I reviewed all those records. And I was always drawn to rock music or anything alternative, anything weird. I think, you know, even if it's like electronic, hip hop, if it's slightly, you know, like left of center and a little quirky, then I'm interested. And so, you know, in college, I started playing in bands. I'm primarily a singer. I also used to play the bass. So I sang in like folk and bluegrass bands, but I also sang hardcore and punk, I should say, like scream for some of my old music. But I think what drew me back into writing was zines and like independent publishing. I wasn't part of the college newspaper. I was a blogger. You know, my very first published clip I wrote for the now defunct feminist website called Feministing. And And then eventually, you know, like Bitch magazine, I was very heavy into feminist activism. You know, I mean, being a student of punk, Riot Girl, like that movement was so inspiring to me. And it, you know, it made me go through my own roots, you know, like my own cultural roots and thinking about rebellious women from my culture, whether it was like, you know, La Lupe from Cuba, or like thinking about, I mean, God, there are so many like Latina punk people that people don't know about. For example, like oh my God, MXPX, like fronted by a Chicano. A lot of people don't know that. At the Drive-In was such a formative band for me. They were from El Paso, Texas. And, you know, it was great for me to go back and think about the music I grew up with and finding all the, basically all the Latinos. I'm like, okay, mi gente Latino, like, where are you? And that led me to, you know, like blogging about this stuff, finding the connections. It eventually led me to write for more established publications. You know, eventually I got my first full-time job at MTV, at MTV World specifically. So we would cover music from outside the United States. That was very formative for me. And I eventually started working at Rolling Stone. I also used to write for Rookie Magazine, but I was mostly an illustrator, because that's another thing, is I come from like zine world, comics world, and anything alt, that's like my bag, you know? So eventually I got to Rolling Stone. I worked there full-time for 5 years, and in that time I founded the first Latin music section that Rolling Stone ever had, and became the first Latina to write a cover story for Rolling Stone, which was about Bad Bunny. And, you know, after that, I mean, it was great. I got, like, a lot of attention for it. I really – that was my second time profiling him. I profiled him 3 times. And while it got me a lot of great attention, you know, it also made me think about, well – you know, how much of my time do I want to give to like one institution like Rolling Stone? I'm very vocal about it, but you know, the fact that it took 50 years for somebody like me to come along and write a cover story was very indicative of how the institution was run. And I didn't know very many Latinos working there, you know, who weren't working in reception or like, you know, custodial positions, and it was really isolating. So when, you know, I got a call from the music editor at the LA Times, Craig Marks, and I got an email from him, and he was like, hey, I don't know if you're looking, but we need a music reporter, and you might be interested in this position. I still had to interview for the position, of course. But he said, you know, I'd love it if you sent in an application. And, you know, I came to LA for my interviews. Oh my God, at like the beginning of 2020, I was here to cover the Grammys. And, you know, I went to the office. I met with like 6 different people. It was like I had to do 6 different interviews almost. But essentially, I was like, okay, this is Los Angeles, you know, it's like a 50% Hispanic, that's the official term, that's the government term, but it's a 50% Hispanic city, and y'all don't have any Latinos, like, writing about music in the paper. So I was like, you could use one. I've dedicated my career to this project, you know, getting more of us in papers and in magazines, and especially writing about this music in English, so that, you know, people who grew up here and may not be the most fluent in Spanish can still read about the music that they love. I think that's very important. So that was uh, That's been a huge part of my mission, and I feel like being at the LA Times has really helped me pursue that.
I think this is just an excellent example of your way of expanding on just these slightly small questions that actually contain so much when we really start to break things down. You've obviously had such a fascinating journey to LA, and because you have sort of gotten into the gist of things and you're busy doing all this writing work, I think for a moment it may be slightly challenging to go farther back and to look at some of these origins, that is, how you got started. You certainly told us about profiling Bad Bunny and then moving past Rolling Stone. And for those of you who don't know, you can go and read Susie's first profile with Bad Bunny at the Rolling Stone website. I totally recommend that you do that. And in fact, we're placing it on the show notes. So there you have it. Go ahead and check it out for yourself.
Thank you.
But I also want to ask you, Susie, a little bit about like the formative stages for you in terms of identifying as a writer. You did mention that you wrote for the paper back in high school. What is it that led you to say, apply for that position in the first place?
In high school, I was such a nerd, you know, or I don't know. I guess everybody says that. And nowadays it's like you have to specify just what kind of nerd you are. But I was such a nerd about music. I was like a punk, goth, emo hybrid. People try and pick sides. You know, there was like that big brawl in Mexico City, the historic fight between punks and emos. And honestly, I think in Florida, a lot of us just sort of melded together. It wasn't that cut and dry. if you could find like alternative friends in high school, especially like other, you know, like black and brown people who were into alternative music, it was like we just stuck together, you know, naturally. And so I started my high school's mixtape club. It began in my history class, and me and my friends, we would hang out in the world history classroom in the mornings, just before school. You know, our bus would drop us off kind of early. And
which school is this again?
I attended Douglas Anderson School of the Arts in Jacksonville, Florida.
Okay.
I was a visual arts major. And so that's where the comics comes from, you know. I still draw to this day. But, we started a mixtape club because this is also, like, peak, you know, indie culture years. I think this is, like, 2003. And we would make mixes on, like, cassette tapes and CDs, and we would bring them to the class and we just like play our mixes
in the mornings.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it became like the club kept going until I was a senior, until I graduated, because it was just such a fun exercise, and people would come and stop by and see what we were listening to. And
you had like a boombox in the classroom or something?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, like some kids would like go and like smoke behind the class, you know.
Do you remember the name of the boombox that y'all had?
No.
Maybe
way.
Not.
There's no way.
I would love to find out the name of that at some point.
Oh, you know, it's just like a boombox with a tape player and a CD player.
Right. But it also must have been so cool looking, right?
I mean, how old are you?
I'm old enough. I'm just your age. Okay. Or I should be.
Okay.
But still, because I remember the lights. I remember the way that the speakers had these curved dimensions to them.
Yeah.
And then the way that they'd light up. And I'm thinking about it for a listener who isn't familiar with any of that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Because like walking into a classroom where there's a boombox, kind of a neat looking thing. Obviously, this became a situation for you all, which is why the club kept going and people kept stopping by, popping in, wondering like, hey,
oh, yeah.
What do they have going on today?
Yeah. Yep. That's literally how it went. And yeah, at first we had this like shitty little, we just had a tape player for a while. It was probably a holdover from like the early 90s. And then we upgraded to one of those silver, you know, Y2K looking boomboxes.
But did your teacher bring that boombox in, or did somebody, did one of the students bring that boombox in?
No,
do you remember?
It was a classroom thing back in the day.
Back
sometimes
in that world
we
history
would have
class.
You know, audio learning.
What is audio learning, or what was audio learning then?
You never, they would do this in like Spanish class sometimes where the teacher would put the book on tape. You know, so they'd like, you know, pop in the tape, and then the guy, the narrator, would be like, actividad uno.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, but this is music before you start writing. What grade are you in? Actually, is this your freshman year?
Yeah, this is freshman year.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're just jamming out in the mornings,
yeah.
Hanging out with your people, obviously getting exposed to a lot of different types of music because everybody brings something different.
Right.
But then when do you go from there to actually writing about some of this?
I was always a writer. I mean, from the time I was little, you know, I used to like fold the, you know, I would take paper from like a Xerox machine at the library or from like my mom's office and fold it in half and then write little novels. I
love that.
Started doing that when I was like 6 years old. I kept a diary. I still keep a diary. And I wrote every single day. And so music, it was like, it's so funny because the diaries from my teen years, it's like a lot of, you know, petty drama, but then it's also like me writing about a CD that I had just bought and was really listening to. So it would be like, oh, you know, so-and-so was being a bitch at church today. By the way, I got a new Deftone CD. It's amazing, you know, and I would write about it. And I was doing that when I was like 13. So it just naturally came to me. And I also was reading a lot. You know, I would read Rolling Stone when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And really, you know, try out my voice. More so when I started writing in the school paper, but it was fun to just kind of put myself in that headspace and be like, okay, I'm trying to be a music critic. What would a music critic say about this album, you know?
And then did your friends at the time read these articles or these critiques and tell you about them? Did you talk about some of the stuff that you wrote or some of the reviews you got up with your peers at lunch or so?
Yeah, that would happen. I mean, sometimes people would confront me and be like, you were wrong about this, you know. I remember, and it's so funny because I'm a big fan of My Chemical Romance, but I remember when
MC
they...
MC Army.
I am part of the MC Army. And when they released Black Parade, I didn't like it at first, which is so contentious, but I don't know. I was writing for them like from the first record. So I had a lot of people, their entry point to MCR was Black Parade. And for me, I felt more married to like the punk hardcore sound of their earlier records. So at that time, I think I said that, I can't remember exactly how I phrased it, but I said that it was very derivative and it was them trying to be the Beatles and Queen at the same time and not quite getting like, I don't know, not quite sticking to what they're really good at. But with time, you know, I thought about it and I was like, you know, there's nothing wrong with a rock opera. It's just, it's an emo opera, you know, it's silly, it's theatrical, that's the point. And I think the record grew with me, but I remember some of my friends being angry that I wrote that.
That's so cool because like you had to remain loyal to MCR's greatness until you weren't. And this was a line in the sand for some folks, clearly.
Right. But yeah, I had people confront me about my reviews, or sometimes they'd be like, "Oh, I love that you reviewed this record. I've never read anyone write about these artists before.
And then actually, how did that feel when somebody said to you, I read what you wrote and I loved it?
Mm-hmm. It was nice, you know, like, I was such a snob, you know, I was a music snob. And there came a time where, like, I had to practice writing about other genres, you know, that I wasn't so familiar with. At some point, you know, like, my journalism teacher, she told me that, like, her students, some of the students complained that I wasn't writing about enough hip hop. And it's true. It's like, I mean, thinking back, like, it really was, like, anti-Black racism. I think my family got really nervous when any of us, like any of the kids, would listen to hip hop because they would be like, oh my God, it's all going downhill. Hmm. Granted, they felt the same when I was listening to metal. But it wasn't as like contentious, you know, and I thought it's funny because I have a little brother. He like secretly listens to hip hop. He's like, don't tell our parents that I listen to this.
Because to this day, they're not hip hop fans.
No, they just, you know, they have like really strong and like racist opinions about it.
Even though they're like in two distinct places, right? They're not, your parents are not together, are they?
No, they're not. No.
So both of them are just avid hip hop haters.
But
on separate islands. It's not like a decision that
decision. No, not at all. It's just more like a, They associate it with like, you know, crime and stuff. And I mean, I don't know. I was listening to music about smashing the state at the same time, right. But they kind of overlooked it. It's racism. But I'm still in high school and I wasn't quite sure why, you know. I mean, I loved a lot of hip hop. I loved Outkast, like, again, going back to me just liking weird music, like
right.
Outkast got freaky with it, you know? Yeah. I loved Missy Elliott. I loved, you know, anything by the Neptunes. And like that, I remember my journalism teacher, though, she pulled me aside and she was like, okay, can you try to challenge yourself? Because you write a lot about rock and that's not necessarily what my students want to be reading about all the time. And so, I remember going way back. I started from the beginning and I decided that I was going to study hip hop. I had one of my friends, Tasha, I was like, can you make me a mix? and we actually traded mixes, you know, cause she was like, oh, I like Bjork. I want to listen to more Bjork and stuff like that. This is art school.
That's definitely an alt scene. I like Bjork. I'll trade you Bjork for my hip hop.
Yeah. But she, you know, she got me into like, I already knew like Jay-Z, but she got me into like Common and Tribe Called Quest, like some of the conscious rappers.
Right.
Because she knew that I was, you know, I was very punk, you know, and looking to listen to, I like a lot of political music. And so it was good. It forced me to open my mind. Like being a journalist did force me to open my mind. And it's not, I don't think that a well-rounded music critic is someone who only writes about one type of music. For me, I think I learned, and also just like following writers over the years.
Right.
You know, like Rob Sheffield was someone that he's a pop critic at Rolling Stone, and reading his writing, he was someone who covered a lot of indie music and punk and stuff. But, you know, he could write about almost anything. And he does it with enthusiasm because I think at the end of the day, he's so, he's just enthusiastic about learning about something new. Yeah. And that's the kind of, I don't know, like position I wanted to be in. I think every music critic should be able to write about anything at least once. You know?
Yeah, and I think it also says a lot about the growth for a writer, especially when you're in these early stages of your career or this pathway. It can take a lot out of you to get past the egotistical side of it, especially because as a writer, you're used to your voice and you're used to making a point and like supporting your point with evidence. When someone comes up and says, yeah, I get what you're saying, but you're still missing this part of it. Really, it's on you at that point to swallow your pride, which is not easy.
No.
And then say, okay, I'll give it another go around. That is the writing process that I think not a lot of people know about, but like it takes a whole lot of internal work for you to force yourself to get to the table with an open mind, as you were saying.
Right. I don't think you should be a journalist if you're not ready to have your mind changed. You know, if you're not open to receiving new information, you just shouldn't do it. And honestly, I think about being a music journalist in high school and the things that it taught me. And that was, you know, the beginning of my process of like shedding my ego. You know, I could have been like, well, I wouldn't be, you know, writing about music for this stupid paper if I wasn't right. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
And now, you know, I'm like a huge fan of, I found so many artists that I'm such a big fan of. Like I love Khalees. I'm so glad that like, you know, my friends put me onto Khalees. Even going back further, I mean, I don't know. I'm from Florida. I know I mention it a lot, but I think about like Trina.
Sure.
And how influential she was. Still is. But yeah, anyway, that's been my process.
Hey, Los Angeles. I hope you're enjoying this conversation as much as I am. I just want to take a moment to invite you to my Patreon channel, which supports JT the LA Storyteller podcast in more ways than one, and which also provides just a little more from each convo. And of course, this is because it takes a little bit of work to put this podcast together, including research and reaching out to folks and scheduling things, and then studio time, editing time, finally publishing, and then a little bit of marketing time. And the Patreon channel is just the best way to support all of that, to support independent storytelling in LA by JT the LA Storyteller. So I would love your support, and I can give you my word that it's going to be more than worth it. Now, back to the show. Wow. Now, just for our reference, once again, when I think about getting into music, especially in these teenage years, I know that on my part, my friends were a big deal. They were like the biggest part of how I became exposed to one artist or another. Mm-hmm. And for my friends, they also had siblings who exposed them to records because they had this cool lineage that they could slightly lean on where like their older sister or brother knew what it was like to love vinyl and go to a show and experience that in a far more visceral way than the kind of digitizing that took place when you and I were in high school, where everything became a little more automated. Mm-hmm. Was that at all the case for you, or was it strictly that you were digging on your own for the most part and finding new music strictly because you were dedicated to that?
Well, I'm the oldest sibling, so I got my siblings into cool music.
There you go. There you go.
I did have older cousins, though, who were very influential. You know, like they were also, I mean, we would all watch MTV together. Mm. We would just sit there watching music videos. And now it's like one of my favorite pastimes. You know, I put on YouTube on the TV and just, you know, just let it roll. But also my parents had really good taste in music.
There we go.
My parents, you know, they had me in their early 20s. They're pretty... I think technically my dad would be a boomer.
Right. It's always funny to think about how they were not necessarily born here. So do they get categorized the same way as people who were?
My dad was born in Jersey, but my mom was born in Belize. And my mom's story is very interesting because it's like Belize was a British colony. So when my mother was growing up, she everything was BBC. So she and her siblings, it was like they would watch Top of the Pops. And
the Beatles. And you mentioned the Beatles.
They love the Beatles.
Oh, my goodness.
They love the Beatles, the Stones, the Who. And eventually, you know, my mom, she really likes prog rock. So she got into, like, Yes and, like, who else? She loves Supertramp and, like, Queen.
Wow. Pink Floyd?
Yeah, anyone? My mom loved Pink Floyd.
We all
both
do,
both my
though.
Parents. Yeah, everybody. And so, and then meanwhile, you know, my dad, it was like he grew up in New Jersey, New York. And so he got like a front row seat to a lot of these movements in like the 70s and the 80s. You know, my dad, he got into punk, but he would also go to like Studio 54, Danceteria. And, you know, like one time he met Madonna at the club.
Whoa, recording a music video or something, or just because?
No, she did like a show at a club, but it was, you know, a small club, but wow. She was still pretty new. And so, yeah, I mean, between my parents, they had an amazing record collection.
Okay.
So, you know, it's just like I grew up with such a rich knowledge of music from like the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Right.
And eventually 90s, you know. So I lucked out in that regard. Not everyone. I mean, I had a lot of friends in high school whose parents were like, they were definitely boomers, you know, and
right.
They would listen to much older music.
Sure.
And that I wasn't exposed to, you know, like I remember listening to the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds for the first time just because my friend Andre introduced me to the record. And
in high school.
In high school.
There
yeah.
You go.
Like, my mom and dad were not into the Beach Boys. They were like, what? That's like, you know.
Oh, they were the original music snobs.
They were music snobs, too. So they were like, oh, Beach Boys, blah. You know, like, that's for old people. Because they were like teens in like, the late 70s, 80s.
Okay.
So
okay.
It, and then, you know, even, like, Bob Dylan. My parents weren't into Bob Dylan.
Right. Okay.
You know.
I'm starting to see a trend.
Right.
Just in that they have high cultural taste.
It's just they were alternative. You know, my mom was like really into new wave. That was her thing. I took her to see The Cure in Miami earlier this summer.
That's so good.
And she'd never seen them live before, but the thing is that it's like we grew up on The Cure. She had their cassette tapes. Like, she's the reason I became a goth, because she was a goth first. I mean, well, she was, like, goth light, you know? She dressed kind of like Boy George in the 80s.
When she was a high school student?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So she had, like, an asymmetrical haircut, would wear, like, a black hat and, like, heavy eyeliner, you know?
Oh. All right.
That was her vibe. So I got that from her, you know? She loved the Smiths. She loves Morrissey.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, things like that, I think, yeah, just because my parents, they're very well-rounded, though. You know, I mean, they also loved Whitney Houston and Mariah. And I mean, I think that they could just appreciate good music.
Right.
It's just they, you know, they had their icks, I guess.
Right. I mean, and it's interesting because especially in the early 2000s, say pre-Kanye West, hip-hop was still very much, at least popularly, it looked like a gangster scene and like a big booming crowd that really, at some point, especially in all likelihood, given the popular opinion at the time, looked mm-hmm. as though it was celebrating criminality or drug consumption or like getting past the man in this or that form. I could totally see how, yeah, like before there were more people our age kind of getting their voice out regarding pop culture, this might appear, especially to an older crowd, like it's just celebrating defiance strictly for the sake of that, which could be a little too much for, I suppose, someone who also has this background in the classics and in some of these other forms that are certainly more refined, that were not as much of a big sale the way that hip hop turned out to be in the early 2000s.
I mean, I can appreciate Kanye's earlier discography, like a lot, because it was so interesting. I mean, Kanye was like part of the blog house scene, or kind of like this, I don't want to call it explosion. It was just like he came out of a really interesting scene in Chicago and played with so many cool sounds. He's a great producer. And I think, I don't know, one of the things is, I mean, like, I know I talked about this revelation that I had writing for the school paper, but to be honest, I really don't, you know, after that, I really didn't think about music as so cut and dry, like, you know, in that way. I don't. I enjoy all kinds of music. And I think music that's made for, you know, that's defiant for the sake of defiance, honestly, still goes. Like, I appreciate the value of that, because we do need defiance in the society.
That's right. I mean, and I think it happens that one generation looks at the next and goes, look at the kids now. I mean,
it's funny. I try not to do that.
Right.
Because, like, I'm in my 30s now, and I try not to do that. I have to say, like, you know, not everything is going to suit me. Not every kind of music is made for me. You know, I do think some music, it's like, now, you know, I have to think about, okay, like, do I want to hear, like, a bunch of teenage boys talking about, like, cars and, like, ass, you know?
Right. Going
like,
back to
this
defiance
shit gets
a little bit. Right.
You know, and that's not defiant at all. Teenage boys talking about cars and ass is like the most like regular thing that that they can talk about in their music. So, you know, I think that kind of thing is so unremarkable. But when you know, when someone comes out and they talk about, I don't know, they talk about real shit, you know, like class struggle, I'm a lot more, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, that's interesting. Let's talk about this.
Yeah. I mean, I think we as human beings are supposed to evolve a little bit, and kind of, as you were saying, let the next round of young pop critics out there dismantle or decipher or dissect some of the music for them, because it is especially theirs. I mean, at least here in LA,
yeah,
when like Odd Future was coming out,
oh yeah,
that divided quite a handful of us, because it was kind of like, yeah, we know that they're young, we know that they're just expressing themselves, they are a little on the raucous side, but why shouldn't they be? Whereas other folks were going, yeah, but the form is deteriorating, man. Hip hop used to be a little more about this or that. You could define it in a number of ways. It was a moment in which the generation split off a little bit, and like,
definitely,
that's okay. And that's fine.
Yeah. I mean, Tyler the Creator was like what we would call a shock jock, you know?
Yes.
It's like he might as well have been kind of like a Howard Stern character or something in hip hop, and he would go places that were deeply uncomfortable and like horrifying sometimes.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, it's so funny, because at that point, I remember I was on Tumblr.
Oh yeah.
I was on Tumblr for that.
If you consider yourself a writer in 2023, you had to be on Tumblr.
You had to be on Tumblr at some point, you know, just to understand like the general zeitgeist of like, especially the millennial generation and some like, some Gen Z, but yeah, I mean, now like Tyler's evolution is fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And now, you know, he's out, he's queer, and he's like, yeah, I was grappling with some things, and I'm just like, yeah, you think?
Right. And that's what other people have to know too, is that like musicians are human beings too. They're not just a form that is supposed to reflect perfection or a perfected state of being, even while some of their output or artistry gets just close enough to that, they're human beings who also go through these paths, mm-hmm. who have to come up and not necessarily change, but evolve mm-hmm. from where they first began. And yeah, it is interesting to think of Tyler's matriculation, his growth, mm-hmm. and what that means for young people like Tyler.
Yeah.
And also folks who are just fans of the form and who love good music that is also, yeah, not at its prime at the outset, but that just may get there with enough time. Certainly his work and his achievements are a testament to that at this point.
Yeah, I agree. And what a like fascinating journey it's been. I mean, one thing, I feel very fortunate to have been like a working music journalist for over a decade now. And it feels fortunate that I'm still writing about this shit, but also a lot of the same people are still making music, and a lot of, you know, their music has only gotten more interesting and layered. And I appreciate being on that journey with them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel about an artist like Kendrick Lamar and even mm-hmm. Drake, actually, because it's like, yeah, if you think about it, 10 years ago, they were kind of in their early 20s too, for the most part. And mm-hmm. now you have to wonder if they're starting to see things differently.
Yeah.
Because why wouldn't they, as life has progressed for all of us, mm-hmm. we've all had to adapt, and it's going to look a little differently from one voice to the next. So yeah, I think it's also really cool that you've gotten to spend time in that space and that you can, you know, look at that more extensively as the days go on. It feels as though, at least I like to think of it as, we age like fine wine.
Some people do. Some people resist it. You know, I think some people resist it a lot. I think about an artist like Drake, and I think he resists it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So that's another interesting thing, you know? I mean, if the albums keep coming, but the subject matter stays the same and the sound doesn't evolve.
Yeah.
It's evident when you can feel an artist fighting that. And yeah. I think Drake could do something really interesting, you know, with time. I can't say I'm like compelled by his music anymore.
Yeah.
But it is what it is. I will always remember him fondly in the show Degrassi.
Everyone will. Everyone our age will, and no one will ever forget about him there.
Yeah. But yeah, I think it's better not to resist it, you know, to lean into it and see where your mind takes you.
Now, with that in mind, I wanted to ask you a little bit about when you first learned of this man named Benito, of Bad Bunny, because I don't know if you knew what the impact of your story would end up being.
No.
I don't imagine you did, yeah. But I'm curious a little bit about when you first heard of Bad Bunny to begin with. Like, what year is it, and how did that happen?
I think it was in 2016. You know, he released that song Diles on SoundCloud, and
wow.
I would, you know, I would get emails about a lot of like Latin trap artists, so many of them, you know. I was at Rolling Stone at the time, and at that point I covered the occasional Latin artist, but I was still, working in like the general market, you know, so like, English language music.
Right. This is before your like initiative and.
Right. Yeah, I didn't get to launch the Latin music section until 2018, you know, once it was, you know, post Despacito.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was in 2016. And I remember like friends of mine online were talking about it, and they were like, oh, this song is so sexy, you know? And
now online, do you mean Facebook or do you mean?
Oh, Twitter.
Okay.
Yeah. At this point, I think I quit Tumblr, or I kind of like phased out of Tumblr around 2015
too, yeah.
Because it was a lot. Yeah, I was like on Twitter a lot more, and for me, it was just, you know, like I said earlier, it was like a passion project of mine to not just amplify Latinas, but at this point, generally, I think trying to amplify like marginalized communities in music and music criticism was really important to me. There were, you know, I think I was part of a wave of young people who, you know, were women, who were queer people writing about music, and an increasing number of people of color, and just other marginalized communities. Like, there were more of us writing about music, and our audiences were getting bigger because there were people who were looking for that. And I think it's related to the fact that, like, you know, I used to be an organizer, and I won't say I was a particularly good one, but, you know, I would organize a lot of like feminist marches. I focused a lot on, you know, like sexual violence and domestic violence, and trying to push for legislation around like the prevention of these things. I was like an anti-rape activist in college. And so that was something I was really passionate about, but I was also really passionate about music. And so it was funny because I was playing in like a punk band, and we would do a lot of these fundraisers for people who, I mean, we were also just thinking about, you know, after Trayvon Martin got murdered and like Black Lives Matter, that was also cropping up.
Wow.
You know, I was
because you were still in Florida.
No, I was in New York.
Okay.
I was living in New York City. I moved to New York in 2007, and I moved from New York to LA in 2021. So I lived in New York a long time. And I was going to Black Lives Matter marches. I was part of the Occupy movement. We had Occupy Wall Street. Yeah. I was very active. And this was in like 2011, 2012. And I was starting to write about music around the same time. And for me, I think, you know, it felt like there was a turning point culturally where people did not want to keep reading about, you know, they didn't want to be reading about this new crop of artists who were more, you know, diverse and who were also like not just like racially, ethnically diverse, but also like gender nonconforming, you know, people. I mean, I think about how big of a deal Lady Gaga was, you know, just her bisexual era. Like,
And all the stir it caused about whether Lady Gaga was actually a woman or not. I remember those combos too.
Yeah. And they tried to use it against her, and she was like, well, what's wrong with, you know, being trans? What's wrong with not conforming? And like, you know, we were having conversations like that 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think the music industry really had to catch up. Another problem is that, like, you know, sexual assault and all kinds of, you know, gender-based violence, that was so common in the music industry. It still is really common in the music industry. And I think that there were just so many instances. I mean, I think about like Kesha, you know, accusing Dr. Luke of rape, and so, I mean, there were so many examples that you could pull from. But this era, I think, really led to a reckoning in the music industry and in music journalism, where, you know, at some point, and by the time I worked at Rolling Stone, I mean, they actually took a survey. I think this was like 2 or 3 years into my time at Rolling Stone, but it's like they actually did a survey, and they found that over 80% of the office was like white and male, you know?
Wow.
These are the people who are shaping music criticism. And yet there are so many writers like me, you know, who are Latina, or like who are queer, who are women, who are totally capable of writing great music criticism. It's just that, like, there weren't very many of us. There still aren't like very many of us actively working in that in this part of the industry. And so like I was very vocal about it from the beginning, and I still am. And I can't even remember what we were talking about before, but well, going back to my claim, I think that the social justice movement of the 2010s directly correlated to who we're seeing in music criticism today. You know, the fact that there are so many more writers of color talking about music, you know, and not just about like now it's like you're seeing more Black writers writing about pop.
Right.
You know, not just being like siloed into hip hop and R&B. They're writing about punk. They're writing about metal. Like, and that's like just one example.
Yeah. I mean, and the proliferation of the online space over all those years mm-hmm. had a huge impact too, because we mentioned Tumblr for a moment. These communities cropped up over time and really leaned on one another to hear voices like theirs reflected mm-hmm. when it came to pop culture or culture just in general.
Yeah.
And just as you said, when you describe the 2010s and a lot of movement making, one can see how it really set up the path for this latest round of conversations around sexual assault, mm-hmm. around gender nonconformity, mm-hmm. around more people of color, not just in film and entertainment, but doing the critiquing just as well, because they have mm-hmm. such an intimate connection with the new and with what is ahead. And this is definitely something that I was happy to get into for a moment with Fidel on our podcast as well.
Yeah.
And again, there's a whole lot that you're involved with, and you know that your culture is waiting to hear from you. And then someday you check out this song by a little known artist at the time, known as Bad Bunny.
Yes. And I believe, just to tie it back to all of this, I do believe that Bad Bunny is the product of a zeitgeist, you know, of the zeitgeist of the 2010s, you know, where people are looking for people were looking to see more of themselves reflected back to them in music. And, you know, especially for like the Puerto Rican diaspora. Yeah. Like, he's someone who, yeah, he started with, like, very sexy songs about, like, you know, just chilling and smoking weed sometimes. But then, you know, Hurricane Maria happened, yeah. and he was very vocal. I remember seeing him on Jimmy Fallon talking about the devastation on the island after the hurricane and the fact that Trump showed up and just threw some paper towels. Yeah. That was so insulting and, like, just to see, like, you know, an MC. I mean, he's a rapper and a singer, but like to see him, he could have just gone the. I want to name names? I kind of want to name names, but like he really just could have gone like the J Balvin route and just made some feel good music that's like not, you know, he could have gone the Maluma route,
right?
He could have even, I mean, I don't know. I feel like Pitbull lost his edge after a while, you know, yeah. and just made like feel good house music. Like
just hits.
He could have just done that and made a, you know, a good career, but he made a great career because he showed his principles very early on in his yeah. career. And I think that's part of what made him excel.
Yeah. And because the community responded so well, right? I mean, he was like an instant buzz, an instant hype. You mentioned SoundCloud, and folks were really blowing him up on SoundCloud, but especially starting in the PR, from what I understand.
Yeah.
And why wouldn't they? They've all been through a lot
yeah.
in Puerto Rico over the last few decades, especially given climate crisis, and then given the political response or lack thereof.
Hundreds of years yeah. of oppression. And it's just like, and the thing is that, you know, one thing I really admire about Puerto Ricans is the fact that they're not letting it go anytime soon, you know? they're not complacent. They are not a complacent people. And I really admire that, yeah. you know?
Yeah, in L.A., we've been exposed to Puerto Rico through some of the greats. I mean, the last that I can recall was Was it Enrique Iglesias?
No, he's Spanish.
Or, but what about his dad or something? Isn't it Enrique's dad who's from PR?
No.
Both of them are Spanish guys?
They are Spanish guys.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they're Spanish.
Breaking that to me.
well, actually, Enrique, like, his mom is from the Philippines.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
Yeah.
But that really checks out, actually.
No, I would say, like, Puerto Ricans who were popular in Los Angeles, like, before... before Bad Bunny.
Yeah.
I mean, like, people here love Daddy Yankee. They also love Hector Lavoe, one of the legendary Puerto Rican singers. I mean, Mark Anthony and J-Lo.
Yeah. What about Ricky Martin?
Ricky Martin.
Yeah.
He lived here for a while.
Yeah.
I think Puerto Ricans only constitute like 2% of Latinos in Los Angeles.
And it's so interesting because you're from New York. I mean, you're coming from New York. You, of course, noted that you were born in Jersey. But I am definitely curious about the Latinidad you saw on the East Coast compared to the Latinidad you're seeing here on the West Coast. And obviously, you could write a book on the difference. But I'm wondering a little bit about what struck you about LA so far in terms of the range here, the range of Latinidad here.
I mean, this place used to be Mexico, you know? it still is, you know, depending on who you talk to, but like it is definitely Mexican dominant, but it's also like it's been nice to meet more Central Americans. Mm. I didn't meet a lot of Central Americans in New York. That's for sure. It's very Caribbean dominated. And, you know, my dad is Cuban, and he's such a Jersey Cuban. It's very funny. He lives in Miami now. But, you know, in New York, it was like Cubans, Dominicans, Puerto Ricans.
Right.
You know,
right.
And we've
seen them in the movies on this LA side. That's been our like exposure to them.
Right, right. And like, you know, there's things about New York that are very cozy for me.
Mm, of course.
It's just like the Spanish over there is different. It's very comfortable. You know,
I would say it's actually faster over there.
It is faster over there.
Which is difficult for someone like me who's used to the Spanish here. And when I'm over on the East Coast, I'm like, I'm going to need you to repeat that a few more times for it to land.
Yeah. Caribbeans are notorious for that. I am not one of those Caribbeans because my Spanish is like middling at best. I think like coming to LA, I really love being in LA. Yeah, the Spanish is slower here. You know, I don't have to be like, más despacio, por favor. Mm-hmm. I don't have to be like that. And I think it's like, again, thinking about the Central American connection, you know, my mom, she immigrated to Florida when she was 16 in the 80s, and some people in her family immigrated to California. So I do have a few relatives in SoCal. I just like didn't grow up with them. But, you know, I love being able to, like, I feel like our breakfasts have a lot in common. Being able to get a Central American breakfast is so good. Like,
oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, because Belize is Central America.
It is. So, you know, it's bordered by Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras.
Right. And there are political tensions there, which we don't have to get into right now.
We don't have to get into it. But, yeah, I mean, just having, like, a Central American breakfast in L.A., it makes me so nostalgic.
So let me just get this correctly here.
Yeah.
Your breakfast consists of, say, I mean, one of your favorite breakfasts, given the Central American background, consists of plátanos fritos and crema, right?
Yes.
Okay, thank goodness. Just have to make sure. And then maybe rice and beans, but I don't know.
Yeah.
In the morning?
In the morning.
Okay.
Or at least beans, you know, like the like kind of refried black beans and then, you know, like a little piece of cheese.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
You know, I mean, I guess some people, they have pupusas, but... I guess in Belize they'll do like fried dough, and they'll call them fried jacks.
Oh, really? Because of course the primary language there is English.
It's English, yeah. So it's got a very it's similar to Jamaica and Barbados and Trinidad, you know, like it's the kind of English that people speak in the islands. That's what my mom grew up speaking.
Of course.
And
of course.
So
wait, actually it sounds more like British English?
No, well, it's interesting. I was telling somebody about this the other day because, again, it was like my mom grew up when Belize was still an English colony.
Right.
And so she can code switch really well. When I was growing up, it's like, so she would go between Creole, which is like, you know, it sounds very similar to Jamaican Patois. My mom, like, it was like she would speak to me and my sister in Creole, and then she would see somebody, or I don't know, or I guess like at work, or she'd talk to like my teachers in very formal English that she learned in school. Mm. You know, she went to Catholic school and the nuns were from England and they would teach them, you know, extra proper English from the UK and the Queen's English, as they say. So my mom was also, you know, she would kind of drill that into us. You know, and growing up in Miami, it made things strange because people tell me all the time, they'll be like, oh, you're from Miami, but you don't have an accent. And I'm like, yeah. Because,
like a Latina accent?
Yeah,
from
like
Miami?
A Latina accent.
Which
I
would be like Cuban or something?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah, like okay. A Cubanita accent.
Oh, right. Cubano, man.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Oye, man, you know? Yeah. Or like, yeah, anyway, my mom did not want us to speak like
that.
Oh,
no.
But, you know, my dad was on board with that, too. I think my parents, they didn't really follow through with teaching me Spanish.
They were of a time. And a lot of parents out here had it that way, too, for their kids.
They were of a different time. And I think, you know, my dad didn't grow up speaking Spanish. He learned it as an adult. And now he's fluent, but it took decades for him. And it's going to take decades for me, I'm sure. But, yeah, it's just like, you know, my parents were so concerned about me and my sister, you know, being discriminated against. They were concerned about whether we would do well in school, whether we could get jobs. Mm-hmm. And so my mom, she taught me how to read really early. I learned how to read when I was 3. But I also, you know, I remember kids when I was growing up, they'd be like, why do you say everything exactly the way it's spelled? Mm-hmm. You know, like, or why do you pronounce everything like that? I had so many people ask me that when I was growing up, but it's just my mom did not want us speaking Spanglish. Mm. And also there was like television. I would watch like Valley Girls on TV.
I was just about to say that in LA we call pronunciation like a Valley Girl thing.
Exactly. So like, you know, I was watching a lot of teen shows. And picking up English that way and like seeing how, you know, the cool girls on TV spoke. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna talk like that.
Right.
And I guess now I have this like weird melange of accents and manners of speaking.
Code switching. That's right.
It's a lot of code switching. And so yeah, my mom is just like a master of code switching. And I think for a time, like even when she spoke, you know, the kind of English that people could understand, she had kind of a British accent, you know.
Love that.
So that's why I am the way that I am.
That's also why you're a writer, because I would wager that code switching is so intimately involved in the writing process.
Yeah.
As you think about how to traverse a genre, how to traverse the, as we were saying, evolution of an artist, code switching is key as you know how to bring more things to the table rather than less. Even though it poses these other challenges and you kind of never fit into just one box, it sort of feels like kind of a lucky thing that you can go from one place to the next and somewhat constantly be in flow. I don't know what is more Latino than that or Latina than that.
That's true. We are, that's one thing that I did observe about LA is that I meet so many, I meet so many Latinos here, mostly like Mexican people, Mexican American people who've been here for generations, you know? granted, you know, I also know like a ton of children of immigrants like me, but there are people who've been here for generations, and you know, some of them have managed to like resist gentrification up to this point. Unfortunately, some people have not, but some people have even been in the same neighborhoods for generations.
Right.
And so I do find that, you know, one of the challenging things about being in LA is being someone who, not just me, but my family, we, you know, I come from a family of nomads, kind of, you know, and especially like, I feel like a cultural nomad in a way where I'm from a few different places.
Yeah.
It's a little, it's hard to feel like 100% any culture. I mean, people complain about this all the time, you know, like, you know, we have to be 100% American, 100% Latino. And I definitely float. And my family, they were all kind of floaters too. And that's like the migrant experience. And I feel like the way that I have been shaped as a person, and, you know, even when it comes to my tastes, the people I hang out with, I've always been a floater.
Yeah.
I could hang out with, you know, in high school, I could sit at like almost any cafeteria table and know people and have something to talk about with them. That's how I was raised. That's how I grew up. And that's how I still am. And I think people in Los Angeles tend to view that very suspiciously.
Hmm.
You know, if you've been here a really long time, I think it's like people are more like trusting of people who, you know, who they can like pinpoint. I wouldn't say that it's only an LA thing though. It's like
sure.
it's kind of like a territorial thing.
It's a city thing, and it's
a city
I
thing.
Mean, and obviously like we're in a tense standoff moment with all the development.
Exactly.
Not just in LA, but in New York and in Atlanta
yes.
and in
oh my God,
cities
in Miami
everywhere.
Now. Like,
I bet.
I can't afford
easily.
To live in Miami anymore.
Yeah, in Mexico City, you've read about this. I
yes.
imagine that something very similar is taking place in Rio de Janeiro and so on.
Right.
It's increasingly expensive to live in the city.
Right.
But it comes at this strange juncture because we are like somewhat at the prime of our working years.
Yeah.
And it's like we got to be somewhere. And also we haven't been heard for this amount of time, for centuries, going back to, say, what we were describing with the PR,
mm-hmm.
but also with the Mexican-American experience in places like LA or in California or the U.S. as a whole.
Yeah.
And it's like we need to be here. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole lot of room for debate and discussion. I do feel, though, that it's definitely an asset to be able to float in a place such as Los Angeles, where there are so many bubbles and where the city is honestly so segregated, and where
yeah.
it can be difficult to see the town because it's not like what you're used to in NYC, where
oh,
everything
yeah.
is just like clicked up together and where you easily jump from point A to point B. LA is a lot more work, or LA takes a lot more work to come to see. And I love the way a friend of mine put it very recently when she said that LA also doesn't work very hard to be liked. I thought that was great because it's like the city doesn't make it easy for you. You only become a part of the city once you independently decide that like you're gonna get out there and try to see more of it. And
yeah.
if you are a little bit of a strange person in that space, then so be it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is true. I think I think it's interesting because it is very segregated. I mean, people New York is very segregated to a certain extent. But I will say like, and maybe I just need time, you know. And I'm developing like a pretty cool crew here.
Yeah.
But it's like I've met my friends in like totally different situations
yeah.
from one another. And I think assembling a crew here is tricky. You know, I'm going on my third year in LA.
Cause you started during the pandemic, which is also
Yeah. But, you know, one of the things that I always prided myself on, and it didn't matter whether I was like living in Miami as a kid or like living in Jacksonville, living in New York, like one of my parents said this. I think it was my dad. He was like, every time I see a photo of you with your friends, it's like the United Nations. You know?
Well, yeah.
I just like, I have to hang out with, I've always been like this. I love hanging out with people from different places, from different cultures, because it just gives me perspective and it's also fun.
Yeah.
So I think that's something that's so core to my identity that I haven't felt like it hasn't been too easy to be that way in Los Angeles, but I am figuring it out.
Of course. Absolutely. And I think what we've talked about today, given your background, given your passion for research and studying the form and the cultures that make up a place, that make up a person, I think you are definitely equipped to study LA and learn more from LA and also contribute where you can, because this city thrives off of that and always has. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited about seeing that develop further. I have to ask you to be sure, just because we were also talking about the East Coast Latinidad, say, versus the West Coast Latinidad, I'm wondering a little bit about your thoughts on spice, on hot spice, on hot spicy food, and if that's like something that that is making sense, or if it's still like a lot. Because even for me, when I visited, say, El Salvador, where my father's from, for the first time, mm-hmm. 5 or 6 years ago, I was a little surprised that like their sauce was a sweet sauce. Mm-hmm. And I thought like, but you've always lived next to this sauce loving nation. Like, I would imagine that there were reverberations from that, but like, it's not as much of a thing. And it really did surprise me one day to get up and say like, oh, like really hot, spicy food is very unique to especially Mexican American communities in LA.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on spice, and do you have a favorite between red and green, red or green at this point?
You know, I think I'm pretty good with spicy food. I find, you know, spices from different countries very interesting. You know, like Indian spicy food, I don't do as well with. I can do Mexican spicy food though. Mm-hmm. I love hot sauce, and you know what's funny? I think like, my love for hot sauce developed by growing up in the South.
Like, oh, okay.
In, you know, Jacksonville, it's the American South. It is the, you know, they love barbecue, you know, they love hot wings. There is like, you know, a regional, like every region has its own brand of hot sauce,
yeah,
you know, that they stick definitely to. But I feel like, I mean, with Cubans, yeah, we don't do spicy. Everything is garlic. It's like garlic and onions.
Mm.
That's it's savory. And we do a lot of sweet stuff too. But I remember working at a Cuban restaurant in New York City when I was in college and being so pissed off because it was owned by this very like posh white Cuban guy who was like barely at the restaurant, but all the cooks were Mexican.
Mm.
And so it was like, they would serve like a medianoche sandwich, you know, like with the ham and the pickles and the Swiss cheese, but then they would put spicy stuff in it. And then they would serve like hot chips. And I'd be like, what are you doing? You know,
that's not the Cuban food you ate at home.
It's not, it wasn't like,
or in Miami. Yeah, or home being home, and then also the city of Miami.
And yeah, because I grew up like, I was a barista. That was like one of the many jobs I worked as a teenager. But that was like the most, I was mostly like a barista and a nanny through even like until a couple years after college. And so, you know, I knew how to make a good Cuban espresso, but I was so, I felt like, the food just did not meet my standards and felt really annoyed by that. And I feel like it was primarily to cater to an outsider's idea of what Latin food entails.
Right. Latin. So spice, like,
right.
Obviously.
No, it's just like they think that we're all the same. So that was really annoying. And I think as for sauces, I do prefer like a red salsa.
Okay.
All
right. Yeah, you're into the salsa then.
Yeah, I'm team red, and I think my favorite hot sauce is Cholula.
Oh, okay, that's a good one.
It's just
that's a great one.
I love the taste. I just I don't like when a sauce is so hot that I can't really taste it, you know?
Yes. Right. Like you're so busy trying to like get through the heat.
Yeah.
That you don't know what else the sauce contains other than the heat.
Right. And now it's like, you know, I put Cholula on eggs in the morning or like
with your plátanos fritos, maybe?
Yeah, sometimes I have plátano for breakfast. Okay. It's funny because my dad and like my Cuban side of the family, they don't like spicy food.
Sure.
And I get it, but I think that's where I've actually been a little Americanized, where I can handle hot sauce.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. I want to ask you as well, just to be sure, had you had a burrito before you got to LA?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good. If you had, then good. But of what you're able to find, like at your quote, typical, unquote, street vending stand, wherever your neighborhood is at these days, what is it that you normally go to? Do you go to tacos? Because that seems to be like the dominant menu item for most folks in LA. Like, I need to go try the tacos. Or do you have like a comfort food there? Because I also know a lot of people who lean on quesadillas. I personally love burritos.
Okay.
Because I just love the beans and the onions and everything mixed in there. Yeah. But what about you? When you see a stand, what's your go-to, generally speaking?
I go for the tacos. I'm lactose intolerant, so I'm not always armed. I mean, I keep lactate on me most of the time, but sometimes I'm caught off guard and I'm not ready. So, I stick to tacos.
And what kind of tacos?
I try and get like fish or shrimp.
Oh, I love fish or shrimp tacos. But can you find those at the stands easily enough?
Here and there, not always.
Right.
In the absence of seafood, because the thing is, I'm still a Caribbean girl, you know, I love seafood. But in the absence, I try and go for like chicken mole. Is like my favorite flavor in the universe. That's like, yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. So if I look to see if there's anything with mole, then I'll do it. If not, I'll just go for the regular, you know.
Sure, sure.
The regular chicken.
And just to be certain, have you had a chicken mole tamale yet?
Yes, and those are the bomb.
Yes, they are.
My grandma used to make those. My grandma made tamales when I was growing up. My grandma from Belize. Whoa. And she would make like regular chicken. I remember there was a time where she made me like a vegetarian one because I was vegetarian at that point. This was in college. And I didn't know that I was anemic yet. So.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, she would make such good tamales. And I remember like one time me and my cousin, we tried to make like our own like little tacos, and we were trying to make masa, and we just like failed miserably.
Oh, really?
So many attempts.
Like in Miami, though.
Oh no, this is in New York. Like we were trying to basically figure out what like our grandma's recipe was, and like the problem is that, and I think a lot of people relate to this. Like, you know, my mom doesn't know how to do any of that. My mom's not really a cook, but my aunt is, and so my aunt was trying to like tell us the recipe by memory, but she couldn't even figure it out because she just eyeballs it.
Yes, of course.
She was like, you just add a pinch of this. And we're like, well, how much is a pinch?
Of course.
You know, and we couldn't really do much with that. So then we looked it up on Google and we were still failing. And we were like, you know what? We would just never, maybe this is not the time for us to master masa, but hopefully one day I would try it again and see how it goes. But those are some foods that I look back on fondly.
Yeah, I definitely wish you the best with the tamale journey because I also have yet to like spend a night out there making tamales, but I would really love to do that at some point because it's just such a lovely, warm comfort food. I just love that I'm able to like put it in my pocket and have it hang out there for a little while and then, you know, pop it out when I'm ready.
Yeah.
And then like it's a big tradition for a lot of different families out here to, especially around December and the winter, to get into the tamale making. And I love that they do that. And I'm kind of like, You know, one of these days, I'm going to get into the tamale making.
I think it would be a good skill to learn and would help me feel like a little more of a grown up. You know, if I could say that I can make my own tamales, like that would be a new level of adulthood unlocked.
That's how you feed a society, clearly, in L.A. Susie, it's been so much fun chatting with you, and I'm so grateful that you have taken the time to join me on this installment of JT the LA Storyteller podcast. I want to ask you how people keep up with you. Where is best? Give us your favorite handle and any other notes we should consider or keep in mind about your work in the days ahead.
Now that Twitter is sinking, it's going through a very the artist formerly known as Twitter is tanking very slowly, however. It's definitely a slow burn. But you can find me on there. My handle is HexPositive. And then on Instagram, my handle is BrujaCore, like hardcore. And I beg you, if you want to get in touch with me, email me, because I don't answer DMs from strangers. So that's my spiel. That's about it. You can also read my work at the Los Angeles Times or the LA Times, latimes.com. I specifically am a columnist now at Delos, which is like our new Latino focus section. It's a great culture section that concerns everything Latinidad. And I think if you've listened to this entire episode, you might like what we have to say.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
In our new section. So go check it out.
Yeah, and I will say that section is active. There are so many stories on there. I thought I was gonna be able to get through the gist of them or the whole of them, and then I realized, wait, this is just gonna keep going. So try to keep up. I definitely recommend visiting the New Delos platform and initiative. It's so much fun to speak with a number of the folks there, including yourself as well as Fidel. I'm excited about what you all are cooking up. And thank you so much for this. Really, I've had so much fun.
Thank you for having me.
It's Jimbo times.